agreement that has been concluded is extremely has a large number of countries, 12, and also accounts for something like 40% of the world's GDP.
Free trade has long been a nearly unassailable totem of establishment orthodoxy. Since the 90s, trade agreements like NAFTA have passed with bipartisan support, drastically altering the economic landscape along the way. Earlier this year, the Obama administration joined 11 other governments along the Pacific Rim to sign the latest of these free trade agreements, called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP for short. It's perhaps the largest and most complex trade agreement in history. While some are hailing the TPP as one of the Obama administration's signature accomplishments, its sheer scale has made it politically treacherous. It's an open question whether the Senate will choose to ratify it. So what is this massive and complex agreement, and what are its implications? Hello and welcome to the Harvard Kennedy School PolicyCast. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader, and you can subscribe to us on iTunes or elsewhere by visiting hkspolicycast.org. You can also find us every week in Boston Globe Opinion and on Twitter at PolicyCast. Our guest today is Professor Robert Lawrence, an expert on international trade policy here at the Kennedy School, as well as a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Professor Lawrence, thanks for joining us.
You're most welcome.
So what is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and how long has it been in the works?
Well, this is a trade agreement that's been in the works for almost a decade. It actually didn't start off with the United States as one of the participants in it, but it sort of snowballed, and eventually we joined four other countries. And later, Canada and Mexico came in, and then finally Japan came in. So the agreement that has been concluded is extremely has a large number of countries, 12, and also accounts for something like 40% of the world's GDP.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are the components of this trade agreement? Why is it? What's at stake here?
Well, it's a huge. Its agenda, the number of items that are covered are huge. Mm-hmm. These include parts that are traditionally put into trade agreements, like market access. That is to say, by and large, the countries all get rid of their tariff barriers at the border to the goods from each other. But it also includes services, mm-hmm. so things like banking or insurance and other kinds of services would be covered. Mm-hmm. It also includes investment, so that firms from each of the countries will be allowed to, by and large, invest in all the others. In addition, it has provisions for things like labor standards, environmental standards, and adherence to environmental agreements. There are a host of provisions which relate to things like intellectual property, to regulatory coherence, and I could go on. Mm-hmm. So it's got 29, I think, different sections to it, mm-hmm. and runs into something like 6,000 pages. So it is a very elaborate and comprehensive agreement.
One of the criticisms has been that for such a comprehensive agreement, for it to be negotiated in secret, and then only to be released just recently, provides very little ability for the general population to have a full opinion on its the whole breadth of what it does.
Well, I think it you know, there are arguments on both sides. Mm-hmm. The question is whether it's difficult to negotiate in a fishbowl. You know, they say things you shouldn't be see being made are things like laws and sausages. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, you know, we have statutory provisions now that we have an agreement. People can see it in full. There have continuously been consultations between the negotiators and representatives from the private sector, from non-governmental organizations, and from unions, as well as members of Congress. So, yes, it hasn't been as transparent as it might have been, but I think in some cases people are a bit disingenuous because all members of Congress have had and these other representatives have had the ability to get access to the agreement as it has been negotiated.
Now that the text has been revealed, were there any provisions that stuck out to you as being particularly important?
Well, I think, you know, it is a very important agreement in terms of its comprehensiveness. Mm-hmm. I think a number of areas where which have been controversial also were, in a sense, catered to. So, as one example, the Australians in particular were very concerned about their cigarette regulations. They have a plain packaging regulation, and they were concerned that it should not be challengeable under the investor-state dispute settlement provision. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out now we read that tobacco has been excluded from the Australian concession.
You mentioned the investor state dispute settlement. Could you actually explain what that is? Because that's also a controversial.
Yes. Although we have something like 3,000 of these investor state dispute settlement agreements mm-hmm. in what are called BITs or bilateral investment treaties. Mm-hmm. And basically, this gives private foreign firms the right to challenge governments if they have had their assets expropriated. And unlike other provisions in the agreement, which really can be disputed if there are infractions by governments, so a government-to-government dispute settlement system, in this case, if a private investor is expropriated, they have the right to challenge the government's expropriation in front of an international panel of three panelists, usually jurists, and obtain binding arbitration. Mm-hmm. So this is an unusual treatment, and some believe that it provides foreign investors excessive protection, in particular from measures which are taken in the public interest, things like maybe health and safety regulations. Mm-hmm. So if a foreign investor believes that, let's go back to the Australian tobacco case. Mm-hmm. When Australia passed its plain packaging provisions, it basically said that cigarette companies shouldn't be allowed to put their trademarks on the cigarette package. And the Australian government was actually sued because Philip Morris alleged that this was depriving them of intellectual property, basically their trademark. So that would be an example, and people are concerned that the ability to claim that a foreign government has expropriated you by passing a regulation, which it might have done for health or safety reasons, could lead the governments to. In a sense, it's giving foreign firms better treatment than you give domestic firms. And it could also lead governments to be more reluctant to pass those kinds of regulations.
Right.
Now, there is language in the agreement as it has come out, which actually stipulates that governments do have the right to regulate for health and safety reasons, and that is not challengeable. But, you know, lawyers are clever, and it's hard to know exactly whether those provisions are going to be challenged or not. And the fact remains, when it comes to the United States, although the U.S. government has been challenged, it has never lost a case in one of these disputes. Those who advocate these provisions point to the need for them, because in several countries there are questions that can be raised about the impartiality of their legal processes.
Now, why isn't this something that can be accomplished just through domestic courts in each individual country?
Well, that's the whole point. Mm-hmm. Would you trust a Vietnamese court's impartiality? Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, the courts in Vietnam are subject to huge government influence. And so, and these provisions arose precisely because you can look at objective ratings, even of several countries that are in Europe, Croatia or Bulgaria or Romania. Mm-hmm. And what you'll discover is that their court system leave a lot to be desired. I think when it comes to, Germany or the United Kingdom or Japan, we could have faith in their court systems. But some other countries, I think questions would be raised. Mm-hmm. And so I think also from the standpoint of the U.S., there's the reluctance to actually make these judgments explicit as to who has a trustworthy legal system and who doesn't. And so the fallback position is just simply to include them in all the agreements.
I think one of the other criticisms is a larger criticism of globalization in general, which is that when we open up trade, we tend to cede jobs, manufacturing jobs especially, to poorer countries where wages are lower, standards are lower for workers. National Bureau of Economic Research estimated that in between 1999 and 2011, between 2 and 2.4 million U.S. factory jobs were lost to China. Do you think that's a worthy concern?
Well, there have been jobs that have been lost to China and to other countries. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting is, firstly, in the case of China, I think that it wasn't because we signed a trade agreement with China. China did join the World Trade Organization, but actually this didn't involve us opening our market to China when she joined the World Trade Organization. China has become highly competitive, mm-hmm. and as a consequence, there has been dislocation. And while I might differ as to the exact number with the estimates of others, I think it's very clear that a large number of jobs have been lost in U.S. manufacturing. Now, we need to see that balanced against those costs have been the benefits that have accrued to us from that trade. And we estimate, we've done some sort of benefit cost calculations in which we look at the costs and then we look at the benefits, and we get ratios on the order of 15 or 20 to 1. That is to say, the benefits are 15 to 20 times the costs. So I would not say there aren't any costs, mm-hmm. but and one of the features of trade is that it does create winners and losers. And anyone who says that they're only winners, I think, is lying to you.
Now, when you're counting benefit, are you speaking in dollars or are you speaking in
Well, I'm talking about the improvements in American living standards that come both on the import side from being able to buy to buy goods more cheaply and to have greater choice when it comes to importing. And I'm talking about the jobs that are created in our export industries, which typically pay workers higher wages. Mm-hmm. So that's the major way in which we've captured the benefits. Mm-hmm. By the way, it isn't only trade in goods, and it's a very important dimension of this particular agreement, and that is that the United States is a major creator of intellectual know-how. And so securing the enforcement of intellectual property is a hugely, not only does it give America benefits in the short run, those firms who have innovated, but it also encourages greater innovation, mm-hmm. and therefore faster growth. Mm-hmm. So there are a variety of channels through which more open trade raises our living standards. A final point that I would emphasize is that the effects of trade liberalization are actually very progressive, in the sense that poor people consume and spend much more of their spending on goods. And it is goods prices that are most favorably affected by trade. We get cheaper goods. Mm-hmm. So a poor person will spend more money on food, more of their budget on clothing, on footwear, on even automobiles. Rich people spend much more of their money on services which are not so traded. So when you see simulations of what is the effect of this trade, what you find is that it has enhanced the incomes of poorer people by much greater percentages than it has enhanced the incomes of wealthy people.
So this agreement, obviously, it includes 12 countries. We have a number of other trade agreements, free trade agreements in place already. But this isn't the whole picture. You might even see this as just the start.
Yes. I mean, what has happened is that we have been unable to make much progress at the World Trade Organization, the big multilateral institution with over 160 members. And so U.S. Has chosen to follow a different strategy, as have many other countries, by signing regional agreements with countries that are more willing to liberalize than the vast number at the World Trade Organization. And so in addition to this TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, if it is implemented, firstly, there will be other countries who will want to accede. It is very likely, for instance, that South Korea will apply. It's likely that Thailand will. Indonesia has indicated perhaps a willingness. So this Trans-Pacific Partnership itself could grow. At the same time, we're also in the process of negotiating with Europe, the so-called TTIP. And so that's going to bring in another vast part of a world economy into a trade agreement which goes far beyond simply removing border barriers and also deals with these issues of getting more conformity in regulations and behind the border kinds of barriers. And I believe that if this process is successful, it is also going to put pressure both on countries who are outside this agreement to either negotiate agreements of their own or to seek to join this one, or ideally to join all at the World Trade Organization. And so I think it's part of a more coherent trade strategy designed to liberalize markets around the world also allow those who want to go forward in putting provisions like labor standards and environmental standards into trade agreements to actually do so. Mm-hmm. It has proven impossible to introduce labor standards and environmental considerations into the multilateral organization, the World Trade Organization. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the interesting things about the TPP when it was announced was the, I guess, I don't know how you would describe them, the corollary agreement that happened specifically with Vietnam over working conditions, et cetera, which weren't part of the core TPP agreement. Is that something, can you explain what that was, and is that something that we can expect to see in the future?
Well, there were very detailed provisions, which the U.S. insisted upon, as a condition for Vietnam's accession. And this goes to the fact that at the moment there aren't really free unions in Vietnam and they're dominated by the government. And the U.S. has given them, I think it's 5 years, to change that situation. And in the event they do not, we can withdraw concessions that we have made to them. So this is a way to promote an improvement in their labor rights. Similarly, all of the signatories to this agreement have agreed to enforce the CITES convention, which is trade, which constrains trade in animals, and preserves endangered species. So even though there is a multilateral environmental agreement, it doesn't have the force of a trade agreement in the sense that countries can't retaliate using trade instruments if other countries don't adhere to that agreement. Mm-hmm. Now they can. So this is an agreement which, and there are also provisions with respect to Malaysia and its trafficking violations or failure to enforce child trafficking, which have to be adhered to. So I think this is a way to advance these social concerns as well as the narrower trade interests. And it's something which we couldn't do in the context of the World Trade Organization, where countries veto our efforts in these in this regard. Mm-hmm. But by the way, let me just add one more thing. I do want to say.
Yeah, sure.
People who believe that this agreement ought to contain labor standards have kind of argued against the agreement on the grounds that it isn't going to be enforced adequately. And from my vantage point, I feel that this is actually a strange position to have, because surely you have to believe that we're going to be better off in having an agreement than having no agreement. Our ability to promote these standards, both in the labor and the environmental area, is surely going to be stronger if we actually pass the agreement than in the absence. Mm-hmm. And so it's not perfect, and indeed it will be incumbent upon us to continue to put pressure on governments, and ours as well as others, to enforce the agreement. But nonetheless, it seems to me we're much better off having it than not having it.
All right. Well, Professor Robert Lawrence, thank you so much for coming on PolicyCast today. Really appreciate it.
You're most welcome.
HKS PolicyCast is produced by Matt Cadwallader and Molly Lanzarota. Special thanks to those who help get us out there every week, including Catherine Serafin at Harvard, as well as Ellen Clegg and Laura Colarusso at the Boston Globe. And, of course, to you for listening in. See you next week.
You've been listening to the Harvard Kennedy School PolicyCast. You can subscribe to PolicyCast on iTunes, Stitcher, and elsewhere by visiting hkspolicycast.org. And let us know what you think on Twitter